I have been, among other things, a vocational counselor and a director for Lutheran Outdoor Ministries in northern Idaho, and assistant dean of students at Gonzaga University for a couple of years. So when I talk about particularly changes in careers, I do know a lot about that. Just happens to be the style that I've used to keep myself working for the past 20 years. The question is, why is midlife transition so difficult? We're probably one of the first generations of people that hasn't sort of gotten into a job somewhere in the early 20s and expected to keep that same job until early 60s at a time when we would retire. It's expected now that people would go through two or three or possibly four different sort of mini careers in their lives. And that's a very different mindset than the ones that we have, particularly from our parents, who, at least my mother's doing just fine on my dad's retirement. It's like my dad was a city fireman, worked in the same place his whole life, and had a very secure kind of a retirement income. And that's the mindset that most of us have when we think about careers. So to think about making major career shifts at midlife may very well just make us shake in our boots, because the kind of security that we know that our parents had to do with staying with the same company for a long time. Even if it wasn't going to be our good idea, many people have already discovered that they might have liked to have stayed in the same job for 40 years, but circumstances of the workplace haven't made that possible. So you may very well have gotten into a company and decided you would be happy to give your life for Sperry Rand, but they decided they didn't need your life any longer. So sometimes what happens is that life simply teaches us lessons that we now are trying to be good sports about having to learn. So the first thing we want to talk about is why is it difficult? What kind of resistances are we talking about? And the first is the resistance of the change process at all. That, in fact, most of us don't want things to change. Now, on the one hand, we say that we do. There's a part in us that always wants things to be a little different. But the truth is, when it comes to major kinds of transitions, we really would prefer that things remain the same. And if you wonder about that, just try remembering when maybe someone close to you, maybe a sibling or a friend in your group, decided to do something very different, and how that seemed sort of strange to you, or how maybe it even scared you a little bit to think that that person's life would change that much and your life would pretty much stay the same. The kinds of resistances to change that we will talk about next week are changes in our self-concept. And that's a major one when you talk about changing careers. That to the extent that very often we describe ourselves by describing what we do, then beginning to think about doing something different requires a different way of talking about or thinking about ourselves. And that's really the most frightening one, the one that's the most difficult to get over. And that is a change in your self-concept. Instead of seeing yourself as a person with X kinds of skills and an X kind of a lifestyle and a work style, to change that is very difficult. Changes in relationships. Oftentimes what happens is that people stay in jobs much too long, in fact stay in careers much too long, because they like the people. And they find themselves real attached to their work because they like the people they work with, and will stay in places much too long because they don't want to interrupt those relationships. That tends to be a problem for me, because I tend to really like the people that I work with. And it's always a sort of a major decision to decide, should I leave this sort of happy group of people and try something new? Well, after you've done that three or four times, what you learn is that there are happy groups of people many, many places. And you'll find another happy group of people. But people who tend to get attached to people and who are real people don't like to leave jobs, because it means ending those relationships. Some people don't like to change, change places, change locations. Some people don't like to change routine. That may be the toughest one. And most of us don't like major changes in expectations. We like it when we go somewhere and know what's expected of us, and know what's expected of other people. And we're sometimes resistant to going to a place where we don't particularly know what will be expected. we don't know whether or not we will be able to meet those expectations. All right. The second one, and the main one that we're going to talk about today, is a resistance to the transition experience in particular. The first things I talked about were simply resistance to any kind of change. But the transition experience is one that by Bridges' definition, really means making a major shift, a major change in the way you see yourself, in the relationships that you have, and in the way you define your meaning in terms of work. And what he says, and as we talk about it, you'll understand why people are resisting it, is that it starts when you admit that you've come to the end of something. And what we're talking about is a mini kind of a grief process. That, in fact, for real midlife transitions to happen, we need to sort of announce to ourselves that we are in a death process, that we are at the end of something. Well, most of us don't want to think that at all. It's like some, you know, if we can change a little bit, that's difficult enough. But what Bridges says is if you're going to pull off a midlife change that really sort of honors a major shift in midlife, that what you need to do is acknowledge that you are at the end of something. And it is like a little death. But he says that it's important because otherwise what happens, it's like even when we were talking about things like the stress management and burnout issues, that it's like trying to add simplicity to a real complicated life. It's like, well, where do you push simplicity in? It really is true that unless you create some holes in your experience, some empty spaces, then there's no room for anything new to come in. And that really is the most frightening part of the transition process. That it means letting go of some preconceived notion you have about yourself. It means letting go of some notion that your family has about you, about, you know, how you always do it this way. It means for many people, it feels like letting go of the very things that provide stability. And it is really frightening. It means in some ways letting go of future plans. If you had sort of a life plan for yourself that started when you were 20 or 25 and you're about 45 and you think, I'm really sort of dead on the vine here. I'm not feeling real challenged. Something's happening. This just isn't going right. I can't do this, whatever this is, for 20 more years. It might mean giving up some notion of how you were going to end your work life. Or even how you would spend your retirement years. It really means the potential of letting go of some of those ideas so that you can let some new thing in. Well, talk like this, it's no wonder that it's difficult to do. And what it means though is grieving and literally letting go of some stuff and grieving the loss of those kinds of experiences. Now, lest we think this is totally impossible, life will put, sort of push and shove you around enough so that some of this will happen anyway. Many people are terminated from jobs before they're 65. So that becomes the possibility of a time for you to grieve and let go of that kind of picture of yourself. People who have, and it often turns out to be mothers, but not necessarily, people who have organized their lives around the needs of their family, needs of children, when those children go, that becomes a death of a certain kind of role or a certain kind of mindset about how you organize yourself. And people who have dealt with that well don't just hold their breath while the kids are away at college and wait for them to bring home grandchildren. That's too long. You will notice that you're turning strange colors, that your life is really lost. That kind of life experience is a way for you to go through a grief or a grieving process. The more creative way to do it would be to assess your own level of disinterest in what you're doing and to say to yourself, there are some things in my current life that I don't need to hold on to forever, that somehow, while I thought they were important, I think that it's time to let go of some of those things to make possible the entering of other kinds of ideas about myself. What I'd like you to do between yourselves, just for a couple of minutes, is to think for yourselves, what kinds of deaths have you already experienced? I mean, what kinds of letting goes have many of you in the room already done? And while you're doing that, introduce yourself to someone near you whom you don't know. And talk about what have you let go of? What in your life this year is different from what you would have expected even 5 years ago that involved some kind of a letting go, some kind of a grief process? But that reminded you of, in some ways, of how common that is. How common it is to for us to have some sense of ourselves that somehow, you know, we just can't pull off for 80 years. That we do have many of those many deaths. It seems to me that the one reason for thinking about this now is to make that conscious so that you can use some of that for the purpose of moving into some other stages of your own life. I think the book by Bridges is best when he talks about the experience of being in the neutral zone, because he says that it's like if you have the neutral zone experience, then you will know you're on your way to a transition. It's a little like it isn't until you look back that you can, with some kind of generosity, call this anything even as kind as the neutral zone. For most people, it's absolute chaos. It's like having no focus. If we don't know ourselves, we all know somebody who's sort of living like that, right? It's like, you know, they're sort of at their wits' ends. They don't manage their lives very well. They're real distracted, sort of absent-minded. I remember one time, and this happened during one of the more than one neutral zones I've had in my life. I appeared somewhere and was going to give a talk, and the woman wanted to know how to introduce me. And I said, I really, you make it up. You know, I don't mind doing the presentation, but don't make me explain myself to you. No. It's one of those things where you never want to go to meet new people, because you can hardly put together two or three sentences about yourself. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it's the time of most insight. It's the time when you're, you know, it's just things that you didn't even used to see before suddenly contain this much meaning. And it's like, you know what it must have been for people to sort of catch on to the parables of Jesus, because there are parables about yourself before you, you know, every day. And it's like, you just can't get over quite how bright you are about yourself. I mean, anybody had that experience? Isn't it wonderful? That must be the good news for the neutral zone, because the flip side of that is the awful pain of going, this doesn't make any sense, and feeling real empty and real lonely. Well, we're in good company, you know. I mean, all of the major myths of both European and American Indian, all of the major myths carry a time of a wilderness journey and carry a time of the ground going fallow and then rising again in the spring. It's like there's no culture that doesn't have wonderful stories about the neutral zone. But somehow, it's like when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't always seem quite so nice. So it's only because you're sort of out of it, we can look back and remember with affection how bright we were and how painful it was. Because when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't have a name. Until someone like Bridges gives it a name. But for the most part, when we're in the middle of it, we don't know that it's because we have let something go and we're sort of on our way to something else. It takes a great amount of faith to believe that the neutral zone is the time when the seeds of whatever new will fill these empty spaces is going to come. So it's a wonderful time. It's a time of both incredible insight and incredible kinds of emptiness. For many people, I mean, Holden Village would certainly be a nice place to come during the neutral zone. The most important thing to do while you're in the neutral zone is to pay attention. And so to develop some kinds of disciplines like journaling, where you make note of the kinds of things that you're thinking about day after day after day after day, so that you can look back for patterns. Some people, while they're in the neutral zone, know that they can't seem to make a lot of sense out of what's outside of them, so will be very disciplined about remembering their dreams. and will write down their dreams every morning and watch for a pattern. For some people, it's, you know, it's just like, just watch for what you pay attention to. Watch for what's interesting to you. During one of my more bleak times, I read the paper. I mean, I would literally read the paper and I would open every page and go, is there anything on this page for me? And I would go to the next page and go, is there anything on this page for me? I mean, that is pretty desolate. I mean, I would go back page after, I mean, everything. Anything. Because, I mean, I'm an extrovert, those of you who are in the Myers-Briggs thing. So I tend to learn from the outside in. So I would just look for any kind of evidence in the universe that would give me a clue about where I was going and what's of interest to me now, what's of concern to me. It's like you go to a movie with a friend and you're the only one who remembers this one little scene. Well, that's because that's touching something in you that's sort of being invited out. So introverts are more likely to get, you know, quiet with themselves and use more like the dream strategy or the journal strategy. Extroverts pay attention to what gets your attention. That during the neutral zone, because if you have in fact let things die, you'll have some holes ready to be filled. And you know, the spirit or the universe, or however we explain it, God will send signals to you, but you want to pay attention. And you know, it's a little like, you know, telling someone sort of in the middle of a disease to watch the pain. Most of our culturalization is to ignore it, is to think, oh, if I just hunker down, I'll get through this too. But we don't want to abort the process, so we want very much to pay attention to that pain and the frustration, you know, in the neutral zone. And your friends will think you're, you know, strange. The same as you probably think some of your friends who are going through this are strange. But if you know somebody who's gone through it, it helps too. I mean, it's like, you know, that some, it's like watching an adolescent sort of manage their own self-consciousness. And you go, oh, I wouldn't want to do that again. Mm-hmm. But you trust that it's a part, you know, of the process, and that it too will have a point. It too will have some meaning. The image of the trapeze, you know, where the trapeze flyer literally lets go of one trapeze before he or she catches the hand of the other one, is the image of the neutral zone. And of course, then there are ways to abort the neutral zone by simply being sure that you've got, you know, both hands attached. You really do need that period of emptiness. And I don't know how long it lasts. You know, Bridges says it lasts anywhere from like 6 months to a couple of years. It just depends on your own process. And it depends upon how much support there is for you during this time. Positive kinds of support. What you can do sometimes ahead of time, when you think that you might be ready to move into some sort of a major change, is to know yourself well enough to know, what is it that I'm likely to resist the most? Because that's probably the one that's going to get shaken off. It's like, what is it that I'm most afraid to give up? What is it that I feel most dependent on, most attached to? And whether that's, you know, some sort of an image of yourself, or whether it's finances, you know, money, whether it's your retirement program. It's good to know what it is you think is the single most important thing that you couldn't live without, because unfortunately that's likely to be the one that this transition is about sort of peeling away. I wish it weren't true, but see, it's like, you know, it has to be true, otherwise it wouldn't be so hard, would it? I mean, we can give up the things that are sort of fringe to us. The reason that this is difficult is that it goes right for the heart of how we see ourselves and how we know ourselves, and how we are prepared to go into the next stage of our lives. So you might have some clues ahead of time about, boy, I'm going to be a tough one on this thing. You know, I'm not going to let go this easily, because that may be the one the Lord goes for. What comes out of that is a new beginning. Again, if you don't abort the process, it's possible to sort of go in and try to repeat the first half of your life a second time. You know, people do that typically with sort of same song, second verse, second marriages. When you go, oh yeah, I get it, you know, this time I'll really be good, and I'm going to find someone just like that other wonderful person. Or that you look for the total opposite, which means, in fact, that it's the very same person. It's like opposites are just the underside of the very same thing. Or that, in fact, you leave a job, and you knew, you sort of knew toward the end, that wasn't really good for me. I mean, that wasn't me at my best. But because it's something you know, you try to find exactly the same job again. Those are ways to abort the process. So what's needed for the new beginning is a sense of risk-taking. Well, if you were nice to yourself during the neutral zone, you'd just be surprised how proud you are of yourself to get out of it. If you've been kind to yourself during your vision quest, you know, whatever that is, you will be better ready, you know, to be a risk taker during your new time, you know, during your new beginning. You do finally have to start something. That's the thing that's tough about the neutral zone, is that sometimes that kind of chaos sort of feeds on itself and you're not sure when to take the first step. So to be attentive to when has this sort of been long enough? You know, when have I been waiting long enough? When is it time to take a first step? And again, see, this is going to sort of bump into some of those things that you may have held on to. It's like, we won't have to move. I probably won't really have to get a job. You know, I can get through this in some other way. It may very well, you know, shake those very things. But it's real important at some point when you begin to think about, you know, maybe I could do this, maybe I could do that, to be ready to take the initiative. Initiative and risk-taking, and to make a commitment. To be ready to make a commitment to doing something new. Because it will be hard work, and it may be expensive. And it will mean sort of reorganizing the way you do your life. And, you know, it's like there's a lot of irritation. It's like, I thought I did this once. You know, I mean, I've heard many people say, I got one college degree. What do they want me to do, get another one? You know, that's a rip. I think that's a rip, too. Those are expensive suckers. But sometimes that's what you will have to do. And that is, I just think that's such a rip. You know, some people are still just barely paying off their first loan, and it's time to get another one. There is something, you know, it's again sort of hearkening back to that, the picture we thought it would be to be an adult. It's like, you know, it's like my folks didn't have to do this. It's like Mom never told me there'd be days like this. Yeah, really. It's like I remember one time looking at big, gorgeous boats on Lake Union in Seattle, and going, all those people who didn't go through a midlife crisis spent their money on a boat. No, I hate it. But, yeah, that's right. If you didn't have to have a second degree or pay for therapy, you could have had a boat. I was saying that myself too. A little breeze 2 days a week. I tell you, it wouldn't hurt. Does it make sense? That this is really stuff from Bridges, and it's a little like I guess I do it because that has been my experience, that it's very tough to make that kind of shift. And the thing is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to become this totally opposite person, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But it does mean that some part of you is being called out that hasn't been used yet. Some part of you is being invited to spend some time in your life that hasn't been used yet. And maybe everybody doesn't go through this. I mean, I think it is altogether possible that some people just sort of grow and grow and grow and evolve and evolve and take change easily. But for some of us, it is harder. So, you know, it's like if you haven't had an experience like this, don't go out and look for it. Yeah, wait, just no. Buy a boat. Go ahead. Buy a boat.
Yeah. I was just wondering if it would be helpful to someone who didn't have a choice but walked in one day and, you know, fired. Would this be helpful?
Yeah, see, this isn't always about, wouldn't it be nice if I could could change my life from 40 to 80, something different from, you know, 1 to 40. Oh, yeah. For most of us, this kind of change is thrust upon us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The end may not be, you know, what nice little idea of yourself would you like to give up? Mm-hmm. It might be you're fired. Mm-hmm. It might be, excuse me, I'm leaving. You know, you were a good wife, but I don't need you anymore. Or you were a nice husband, but you're sort of boring. Goodbye. I mean, kids leaving home. Oh, yeah. See, life will bring these to us. We don't have to be too friendly about them. It's just that if we know what's happening, then we can deal with it in a way that's somehow we participate in it, and it's a whole lot easier process if we get on board with it and have some sense of what's going on. But, oh, yeah, for most of us, we would have been just as happy as clams to just get in there and put some money in the retirement fund and get out and live well when we're 65. Yeah. Other questions or comments?
So one thing you didn't mention about resistance was the fear of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of failing when you get out there and you start that new job.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because whatever you've been doing, you know you can do that because you keep doing it every day. So you have some sense that, yeah, I think that's what I meant when I talked about changes in expectations. Is that, somebody might want something from me that I don't really know if I can do it or not. And that's, yeah, that fear of failure is very high. In fact, if that's the one you thought of, that might be the one you want to jot down for yourself. It's like, yeah, you know, I don't mind. I don't mind. Yeah, I don't mind doing something. I don't mind changing, but I don't want to fail. You know, I mean, I want to do well. I want to do something well next time. Yeah. The next one is resistances of personality. And some of this is, again, depending upon how much you're sort of trying to move from what you've been to what you're becoming. Phrases like, you know, that just wouldn't be me. And I hear this relatively often, and this is a pretty simple example of a change. But, for example, like in a company when someone's moved from a lead worker to a supervisor, from a supervisor to management, that they see themselves so clearly in that role. And then someone says, you know, I think you'd be a good manager of this department. And they say, oh, no, that just wouldn't be me. Because they have a picture of themselves that doesn't include whatever it is they imagine that next stage is. And I'm sure, you know, people, you know, probably have come up to you many times in your life and said things to you about, you know, have you ever considered sales? You know, that's a great one. People, anybody who likes to talk, somebody out there thinks out of you in sales. People, you ever considered sales? Oh, no, that just wouldn't be me. So a lot of times people will get a sense of what they think you should be doing, and they'll offer those, you know, like, probably more than one of you have been told to teach the high school Sunday school class. You know, oh, no, that wouldn't be me. All sorts of things that other people imagine that you could do. I mean, you know, really imagine you could do, and that you could do well. And you go, oh, no, I wouldn't do well. I wouldn't do that well. Well, part of it is, I mean, they have some kind of a picture. I mean, you may be right, but they have some information about you that you may not be letting in. So, you know, we have to watch for those kinds of resistances of personality where in fact, we think we know what's best for ourselves, and we may or may not. I'm going to ask you to talk to each other again, but we're going to have to keep it down. The issues around resistances of personality are oftentimes real childhood kinds of issues. It's like there's some kind of a rule that you've had in your family since you were very young. That might not even have been spoken, that keeps you from making some major kinds of changes. And some of those are, it might be, like, be successful. It might be important. It might be, for some people, be visible. I mean, everybody in this company will know who you are. And some people will go, that isn't me. You know, I sort of work behind the scenes. I'm not basically visible. For some people, you might be breaking a rule that says, be happy. I mean, you might have been expected to be in a job because that's your duty. So what would happen if your second career or your second sense of yourself, now that you know you've done it on duty, you decided, this time it's to be happy. people, you know, that if that's breaking some childhood rule about how it is to be in the world, you're up against a very strong resistance of personality. We're going to do some things next week on the self-concept and how we work to change our self-concept. But that's a real tough one. So what I'd like you to do is quietly talk to each other and talk about, if you were in a transition, what's the childhood rule that you would be in danger of breaking? It's like, what's that rule that you have to watch out for breaking? The ones that if your mother and dad, whether they're living or dead, look at you and watch you in this new thing go. Yeah, usually they're little short little buggers. Usually it's not, most of us never heard our parents give us a whole paragraph of rules, right? But somehow they just come up. And yeah, this is not to point blame at parents either. You know, they're carrying their own list of shoulds from goodness knows. It's like if anybody ever has any trouble understanding original sin, you know, it's all of the things that we simply continue to do to ourselves and to others out of the very best motives. So, yeah, lots of sort of unspoken kinds of expectations, which sometimes you may never, literally never have heard that line until suddenly you're up against a major change. And you can't figure out why you're having trouble getting on with it. So if your trouble is with taking that first step and making a commitment to some new thing, you might want to suspect that it's some real old, real young kind of rule about what life was going to be like and what you should be doing about it. What Bridges recommends, and I would recommend myself, is that this is a good time for adults to use therapists. It's a good time to see a counselor and get someone who is sort of a fair judge of the world and of you, who can listen to you talk about why you're not doing what you know you need to do next. Because that person may very well be the one who can simply erase some of those rules and help you see yourself in a way that you need to be ready to see yourself as, so that you can get on to the next stage in your life. The other thing to do, sometimes people will have real significant events in their childhood that are just real hard to shake. And it's amazing how many people will have, it's like have a parent, let's just say you're 45 and you feel like you're ready for a major transition. And at 45, your dad lost the farm. Or at 45, your mother got a divorce. Or, I mean, some major family calamity happened. And, you know, the implied sense is that that's going to happen to me too. I'm really doing the same thing. This is going to be just as big a disaster as when dad lost the farm, or dad lost his job, or mom got a divorce. See, it's it may not be just coincidental that your major shift is at the same time as your parents' shift. But what you want to do is go back and understand those events with a more generous spirit than you would have had when you were young, and with a more generous spirit than your family member would have had when that was happening to them. What you want to do is sort of reprogram your own past so that you don't say to yourself, yep, this is just like dad's heart attack. I'm not having a heart attack, but I'm just going to get myself in a lot of trouble because this is the same year he had his heart attack. See, I mean, that's, you can redo those events so that you essentially build on the positive in terms of change, but you have to change the meaning of that event. It's like, if I keep doing what I'm doing, you know, I may have dad's heart attack for myself. Instead of that, I'm going to make some major changes for myself. And that will not, therefore, be my end. I'm going to treat myself better. So it's real important, if you think that you're up against some real strong kind of family curses, maybe, is another word for it, that you go back and remember those events and redo them and give them a different meaning. Rename them. You know, give them a new interpretation that supports your growth and development. You may need to quiet some inner critics. We'll talk more next week about those critical messages that we get from our parents and how we need to redo those. Sometimes, I mean, the practice of writing a letter to all the people who are going to be disappointed that you didn't stay in this job your whole life, or that you didn't stay with this particular picture of yourself your whole life, you might have to write them a letter, and you might want to have it and throw it away, and you might really want to send it to them and say, you know, I know that you really expected that I would do this, but I'm making a choice to do this, and it doesn't mean that I don't still care about you. It doesn't mean that I'm still not happy for the things that we did. So that if there are either real or imaginary people that you think are real critical of your change, write them a letter. The real letter is for you, of course. And then if you choose to mail that or not mail it, that isn't what's most important. But you may want to do that as a way to somehow bring that person's ideas into your foreground and have you deal with it, negotiate with them. Make promises to never forget them. Whatever it is you're afraid that you might do, sort of, you know, get yourself past that hurdle with them. Questions about resistances of personality or those kinds of internal things?
What did you say? Don't make promises you can't keep? Or my mother might have said, don't bite off more than you can chew.
Uh-huh. Well, probably most changes will be more than you think you can chew, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a double-edged one. Don't make promises you can't keep. If you make any change, it's like you've got to break some old promises, probably. At least some implied promises. And don't bite off more than you can chew means, you know, don't take up anything new. You probably won't do well. Yeah, those would be two tough ones to get over. So you want to work with those two statements. And write, you know, or talk it through, like, those aren't very helpful. There might have been a time when that was helpful. I'll bet when my mom told me that, here's what she meant for me. But I bet if she were here today, here's what she would want for me. And give her that same generous spirit that you want to give to yourself. Yeah, those are two very good ones. Yeah, I'll bet a lot of us are sitting on those. The external resistances, I mean, the most important thing is that you get rid of your internal resistances first. If you don't deal with those, everything will look like an external resistance. So assuming that you've dealt with the internal resistance to change and the internal resistance to being in the neutral zone and feeling crazy and the internal resistance to dealing with a change in how you see yourself, there may be, after that, some real external resistances. I mean, some of it, stuff about this, it may cost money. You may have to go back to school. There may be people around you who think this isn't a very good idea. You want to be through with your internal stuff before you get to the real external resistances so you can tell them apart and so that you can deal with them. Sometimes external resistances have good information for us about the, you know, because we might be, you know, we might be sort of going off a deep end. So listen to it. If you've dealt with your internal stuff, you'll be able to tell the difference because that'll come to you as sort of objective information. If you may have someone who's real close to you who's more scared about this now than you are, so it's always important to have sort of an objective third party to talk some of these things through with, particularly with, I think, with spouses. When one spouse is looking at some kind of a major change, the other spouse knows it's going to affect them, and they may not be going through this little process very well. So to have access to a good counselor is real important, both for you and your move, and to help this other person sort of manage his or her anxiety while you're in the process of changing. It doesn't mean that you're supposed to keep this change from that person, but what it does mean is that you don't depend on this person who's more afraid than you are for your support. I mean, that's not fair to you, and it's not fair to them. So you may want to find, you know, some other way for them to deal with their anxiety. It's, you know, can you give them more information about what you're doing? I mean, if you're with, you know, children or a spouse who is real anxious, the more information you can give them, sometimes the better it is. It may increase their anxiety, but at least you're not keeping any secrets from them. So you don't want the process to get real isolated. But you don't want to have to depend on their fear to interfere with your own process. Usually what you can do with those kinds of external resistances is every time one of those comes up, sort of run by, what's the worst possible thing that could happen if I do this? And go ahead and list what's the worst possible thing. And then look at it. Is that realistic? You know, is that really going to happen? What am I looking for next? How many of you in here were with me on Tuesday when we did the Myers-Briggs learning style assessment? Only a few. Okay, this is, we're going to gallop through this again. Essentially, according to, well, these are sort of Jungian categories, but the Myers-Briggs learning style inventory says that essentially there are, we're likely to start life using one of these as our sort of our dominant, our strong point. That is, we either are sensates, we're either very realistic, we're very much in the world, we make wonderful practical decisions, we're real grounded in real life, or we're real visionary. The N means intuitive. The S is sensate, and the N is intuitive. The intuitive people tend to be real hopeful, they tend to be visionaries, they tend to love causes. These are the sort of the realists of life, these are the romantics of life. Or we make decisions by thinking. We're very logical, rational, sort of put our lives together based on logic and rational thinking. Or we put our lives together based on feelings. Like the most important thing is people's relationships, and we like harmony and all of those things. Well, what am I looking for next in this sense is that it's like you start by developing, you know, one of these as a young person. For me, my first developed trait is my intuition. Later, like in junior high or something, you'll develop the auxiliary functions, either thinking or feeling. Later in life, the thing that's waiting to develop in you is the thing that's most unlike you as a young person. So some of you will have to sort of think about, how have I changed over the past 10 or 15 years? For me, it's the sensate part. It's the part about being, you know, really realistic. It's a part about living in the moment in my body, not in my imagination for the future. For thinkers, if your dominant style as a young person, as a young adult, was to be a thinker, then the part of you that's waiting to be born is your feeling part. The part about being more sensitive to other people, more being interested in other people. So in some sense, I mean, it seems to me that this is why this is so important. And in some ways, some people don't go through what we would call a major, like a transition or a crisis. But there is, I think, in all of us, some kind of movement toward wholeness. And your midlife transition may have to do with your picking up one of these other styles that you've essentially neglected for the first half of your life. At least that fits the way we understand those categories. And I think it makes good sense for, you know, people in terms of adult development. It explains why you could have a life that's perfectly wonderfully happy and a job in which you're perfectly wonderfully happy for 20 years, and then pretty soon that same stuff just isn't so interesting to you anymore. And you go, well, you know, why not? It's like 5 years ago this was good enough for me, and 10 years ago was good enough for me, but now I'm sort of bored by this same stuff. It seems to me it's just natural, it's just normal. That what's happening is that it's time for you to develop some other faculty. And it's like that part of you that's coming into those holes in your life, that you would move and develop the opposite side. Now, many people are developing these opposites their whole lives. You know, many people sort of work with these opposites relatively well their whole lives. But for most people, they use their dominant, and then it's time to add the opposite. So you have to sort of understand enough about yourself to know, what was I like about 10 years ago? Or how am I different now Like, are there some things that are more important to me? And are they, it's like, are those things more important because I'm really working for some kind of balance, for some kind of wholeness? The place where the midlife transition becomes a midlife crisis is when you don't integrate your opposite side. Jung talks about that as the dark side, the undeveloped part of you. So the theory is that the intuitives, for example, who live mostly in visions and in the future, tend to neglect the present and particularly tend to neglect their bodies. So intuitive people are real prone to diseases. If they don't sort of pretty soon catch on that it really does matter about the very this very present moment and what their health is like. They tend to neglect issues of health. Sensates tend to neglect issues of sort of a romance, vision, meaning, sort of things that are out there. And so they tend, these are sort of your typical, like accountants and people who do details really well, who love order. What happens is that order suddenly bores them. And they need to look for some kind of creativity. That's the split at this level. So if for most of your life, you've had a perfectly ordered life, it served you very well, and now pretty soon, it's like you don't want to balance a checkbook. You want to go out and smell the flowers. You very well could be working for some balance in this area. Sometimes if that part isn't integrated, the sensate is most vulnerable on the intuitive side to it's like crazy sorts of ideas. It's because they don't know that part of themselves very well. So it's like you might join a cult somewhere. It's real possible. The thinkers and feelers, again, for the feelers, it's time to start thinking. And it's like the only thing that's important here isn't how we all feel about this. There's real information here. And, I mean, on a good day, the feeler tends to balance his or herself out by maybe going to school, taking some classes. On a bad day, they too are susceptible to really crazy thinking stuff. It sounds logical. It sounds reasonable. The thinker, on the other hand, is real vulnerable to just sort of lots of high affect, you know, strong feeling kinds of situations. Again, if they haven't integrated it. So the midlife transition is a chance for you to pick up your underdeveloped side. It probably won't be the thing that will become the center part of your life, but chances are, like if you start here, either thinking or feeling is likely to become sort of the center of maybe a vocational choice or some new interests. If you start as a thinker or a feeler, you may move up into one of these as something that perhaps would carry the seeds of a new job or a new career or a new interest. Did that make any sense, especially for those of you who've never heard it before? Did that make some sense? Okay. The book in the bookstore that I recommended for the Myers-Briggs is Please Understand Me, which is a very good book in terms of those developmental styles. So one thing that we're looking for is development of ourselves. The other thing, whoops, that's the bell to go to a chapel, are to ask yourself questions like, if I were to die tomorrow and this were the end of my life, what would I have missed? Some people have some very clear senses of, it's like, I'm not done yet. And if you can articulate, you know, if I were to die tomorrow, what would I have missed? You are on your way to making a major decision about something. And the part of the point is that it doesn't have to be work. Some people get so focused on that work is sort of the organizing principle of our life, but you may make a decision that work will not be the avenue that you will use to make this transition. It may be work, but on the other hand, it may not be work. If we weren't so focused on work as the thing that provides our identity, we would have a whole lot more freedom to move through some of these transitions. Work may very well be the thing that you'll want to change, but it may not necessarily be the thing that you'll want to change. We'll skip the stuff on career styles. It just means, you know, there's lots of ways to manage a work life. And this has something to do with the chart that's available on those three handouts. But let me just say, in conclusion, under what to do now, there are some, the possibility, like once you're on to what it is that's missing, once you've made a decision about what part of my life do I want to add now, the first thing to do is to look and see how you can add that quality to your present life. You know, is there something you can do right now that you can reformat or rethink how you're doing what you're doing so that you do that in a different way. So that you know, you don't have to stop everything and completely change your life. If in fact you want to make a major career change, make a list of what your resources are. I mean, who else do you know who's doing work like you enjoy? You can get yourself into a vocational workshop with someone and sort of walk through step by step, how do I look for a new job? Many people make a major transition by developing a hobby and then expanding it, essentially turning that, it's what Bridges calls a composite career, that you would start with one day a week or one evening and you have a little woodworking hobby that you do in the basement. And then pretty soon, you're doing that more than you're doing your other job. So that you make that kind of a transition in a way that's more orderly in terms of your own needs. It seems to me that another way that is available to us is to rethink the nature of work and what meaning work has for us. And think about the varieties of ways that you can act out this new person who is waiting to be born inside of you. And if changing jobs is not a possibility, how can you rethink of what that 40 or 50 hours a week means and put energy into some of the other parts of your life where you may in fact have more control?